Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, welcome to the Snooker Scene Podcast. I'm Dave Hendon, and congratulations to Karen Wilson, the 2024 World Champion. And how wonderful to be able to say that. Whoever wins it, of course, it's a great achievement. But I think there's something special about a first-time winner, to experience that for the first time. And Karen has been on the shortlist for a while as a possible new winner. He seemed to have dropped down it a little bit this year. His form hadn't been great. We hadn't really seen him too much, and he'd spoken about few off-table issues. His wife had been ill, his son had been injured at school. All those things didn't point necessarily to him doing well. I actually listened back to what we said about him on our predictions episode, and to be honest, we kind of dismissed his chances a little bit. My own personal view was that the draw didn't favour him. I thought he was going to play Selby in round two, and I thought Selby would beat him, but of course Mark Selby himself had been beaten by Joe O'Connor. Anyway, Karen couldn't care less about all of that. He's the world champion. What a dramatic final it turned into. It didn't look like it would be at 7-0, you know, with visions of session to spare and all that. Jack Jones, to his great credit, dug in. Massive last frame on the first day, of course, on the black. Wilson needed the snooker, won it on the black, to make it 11-6 rather than 10-7. The Monday afternoon session was drawn 4-4. So Jones, okay, kept pace, but he didn't quite make inroads. But then the evening session, Jack Jones was the better player on that evening session. Karen Wilson struggled to find fluency. Whether that's pressure of getting over the line, I don't know. But 17-11 to 17-14, it got very interesting. They were both making mistakes. I mean, it wasn't a classic final as such, but it was exciting. And Karen got the job done in the end. The actual match ball, I was saying to Sean Murphy at the party last night, and by the way, at that party you have to shout to be heard in any what anyone's saying. But anyway, I was saying like the way he struck that, I thought was really great. He hit it with great authority. It was missable at that stage, particularly after what had been happening. And then he celebrated, which I've got no problem with at all. Why wouldn't you? Because it's not just the match, it's not the 17 days, it's all the years of struggle. And he spoke, I thought, very movingly about that afterwards. You know, his parents remortgaging the house, driving him up and down the motorway, not being able to afford hotels. All that stuff is true. They're not, you know, from a rich background at all. He's an ordinary guy, but really nobody's ordinary. You know, it's extraordinary just to be alive. And what you choose to do with your life, or sometimes what life chooses to do with you, is interesting, whoever you are. And for Karen Wilson, it was to play snooker. His head teacher gave him Fridays off school to go and practice at the local academy. He had advice from Peter Ebden at a young age. He's had advice from a lot of people. Barry Stark, it was nice to see him there. He's a long-time coach. Obviously, his parents, his wife, even his sons, his brother. A family affair, absolutely, and a team effort to a degree. But out in the middle, it's entirely down to Karen Wilson. And he's the world champion through his own merits, his own self-belief, his own discipline and positivity, all of that. It all came together, and it's terrific. I'm so happy for him, actually. He's a nice guy, Karen. What you see is what you get with him, I think. And, yeah, it was an emotional evening for sure, and a nice end to a tournament that, at times, let's be honest, was a little low on drama. It wasn't a vintage world championship, but it doesn't have to be exciting. It was still very enjoyable, and, well, like tears in the rain, it's been washed away for another year. Matt Hewitt loves to go in and take a picture of it all being dismantled, which I think is one of the most sort of heartbreaking things you'll see. The tables coming down and everything being taken away. But what a ride we had. I mean, I was there day one, morning one of the qualifiers. Jensen Kendrick, Bayou Liu was the first match we did. 4 weeks later, we're there doing the final. A great thrill, a great privilege. And, yeah, again, congratulations to Karen. I left the party reasonably early. I say reasonably early, about 1 in the morning, but it didn't start till 11. And it was in full flow. A prominent member of the snooker fraternity had split his trousers. It was dancing rather energetically, but that's a side issue. Karen, quite rightly, was enjoying himself, and less enjoyable was the fire alarm that went off at 4:30. And I've no details on that, but I can guarantee it would be something to do with what was happening at that party, whether it was still going or whether there was a sort of after party, I don't know. It went off about 4 or 5 times, which is not ideal in the middle of the night, but anyway, we'll get over that. But anyway, that's it. Now, I'm going to do... there's a lot of emails coming, as you'd expect, and we'll be going to them, but I'm going to do this slightly differently because I've decided this year to do a list of my hits and misses from the tournament. So these are things that I thought were really good about the tournament and things that were really bad. And they're not matches. They're things around the event. The matches kind of speak for themselves. Everyone will have a view on them, and we'll get to some of the details of that later in the emails. But this is more the event as a whole, a sort of overview. Just on that, by the way, I have written a piece for Eurosport, the website, about Karen Wilson and the championship. If you want to check that out, it's online right now. So we'll start on a positive note. What was good about it? I want to mention the staff who work on the event, and that's the World Snooker Tour staff, many of whom came straight from the qualifiers, and of course, most of whom, well, all of whom really, you know, followed the tour throughout the season. It's a long, old haul, and people are away and to an extent putting their lives on hold to give everything to not only the tour, but of course this championship. There's a lot of planning that's necessary, a lot that can go wrong. They're long hours. Often you're in the middle of sort of controversies beyond your control. And look, they put on a great event. And I think World Snooker absolutely put on great events. But specifically, I also want to mention the Crucible staff, the actual staff of the theatre. There's a lot of ignorant comments being made about the Crucible and its future and its sort of functionality. But the staff there, of course, who work there all year on productions and keeping the theatre ticking over, you know, they do a sterling effort. They never kind of mentioned, even just coming in, for example, on Friday of the semi-finals, the afternoon session between Stuart Bingham and Jack Jones, it went very long. And they had about 20 minutes to get the theatre turned round to bring the audience in for Karen Wilson, Dave Gilbert at night. And the staff descended, you know, picking up litter, you know, getting the Hoover out. All the stuff that no one ever thinks about, but actually is very important for the next lot of people that come in so that it's clean and they have, you know, so we're nice to sit, all the rest of it. I just think those guys are never mentioned, but the Crucible staff and absolutely the World Snooker Tour staff deserve a mention for keeping the wheels spinning. And I think someone else who deserves a mention, on a similar vein really, is Rob Walker. It's not really until you're in the arena that you realise actually the sheer effort he puts in to... I'm not talking about the intros. I mean, they're brilliant in themselves. I'm talking about beforehand. The effort he puts in to making it feel special for people. And it's not just, you know, the welcome that he gives them. It's actually very specifically, it's someone's birthday, give them a round of applause, or that someone's travelled from Finland to be here, or it's someone's first time here, or so-and-so's won a junior event, he's a promising snooker player, or it's a cameraman's, you know, birthday, or the anniversary of covering the event. He did a nice thing for Paul Collier, the referee, last night, retiring. You know, it's every session that happens. And even, I mean, I get a little bit embarrassed by it. He gets the crowd to applaud the commentators. I mean, they can't hear the Eurosport commentators. But he always says nice things. And, I mean, I look down on the floor, you see the greats in punditry, you know, world champions and legends of broadcasting. I often look at that and wonder what the hell I'm doing there and why anyone should be applauding me. But the fact is, Rob tries to make everybody feel special. And he does it session after session. And, of course, he's not just doing that and introducing the players. He did commentary for the BBC. He did interviews. He does interviews for World Snooker. He does tours around the venue. I mean, I was there the weekend and one of the security guys came in with some people, I believe, from Kazoo, the sponsors. And Rob didn't know anything about it. They said to Rob, "Oh, would you mind showing these guys around the Crucible?" And he was in the middle of something, but he just did it. And it's all day long, basically. And I think he's the sort of person, Rob, you would miss the minute he wasn't there. So I think I just wanted to mention him as, you know, one of the great stalwarts now of the Crucible experience. But there's no doubt one of the real hits every year, and I felt it again personally this year, is the fans and the community spirit that they generate. And it's everywhere you go around the location of the Crucible itself, Tudor Square. If you walk up there, people want to chat to you. The Graduate is the club a lot of people go in. There's always a good atmosphere in there. And we've had emails from people who may have travelled on their own to the Crucible but have just met up with people because you've all got a shared interest. And you get talking, you're all there for the snooker and you find out about each other. And I know that lifelong friendships have been made in Sheffield over the years. That's something I think that sometimes the sort of powers that be and the players don't think about. You know, they don't think about the sort of community aspect of it. I had some very nice chats with people, and people were very kind and said nice things about this podcast, but it's not about that. It's about being there for the right reasons, which is to enjoy the snooker, the positivity as well. I mean, this is a thing. If your only prism in life is through social media, you know, you would think that the world is a pretty horrible place. But in real life, of course, it isn't. In real life, it's full of people who've spent the money, made the effort to come. They want to chat about the game. They want to enjoy the game. And they did. And that atmosphere around the Crucible never used to be like that. When I first started going there, it wasn't the same. And actually, I do think, to be fair, things like social media have helped bring people together in that way. But now the sort of the tentacles, if you like, of enjoyment have spread. It's not just the Crucible itself, it's the surrounding area. And it was a lovely atmosphere all the time I was there. Everyone I spoke to, or who came over and spoke to me, was friendly and engaged in what they were watching and had views on it and wanted to talk about it. And that's brilliant. I also want to commend, actually, the BBC website, because they haven't always gone big on snooker, but I thought this year they did very good work. They had live sort of blogs going on, live updates. The thing about the BBC website in the UK is the BBC is an organisation that is constantly sort of bashed from both sides of the sort of political fence, but actually it is still one of the most trusted organisations that we have in terms of news, in terms of information, and the website is used by millions of people every day. And as I say, they haven't always gone big on snooker, and certainly outside of their own events. That's something that needs looking at. But I thought for this championship, there's a guy, Steve Sutcliffe, who is their main snooker writer now, who does a very, very good job. A good guy, actually, does a good job and sort of understands what's happening. And obviously, Jamie Broughton on BBC Radio, Shabnam, Eunice Jewell on BBC Radio, also doing great jobs. And, you know, we were talking about BBC coverage. We normally talk about the television, but actually I thought the website this year was good. And I think it's important to mention that. I also want to give another shout out to Alan McManus's podcast, The Snooker Breakfast. He kept it going every day, which is no mean feat, because he said this himself, he would record it every night after studio. It's often quite a long day. It's quite tiring. You might just want to go to bed or just have a drink and relax. You don't necessarily, you know, jump out of bed and say, "Oh, I want to record a podcast." But he did it, and he did it every day, and it was very interesting. He gave good insight, you know, things that maybe other people hadn't considered, all from the standpoint of someone who's played at the Crucible, who works there now as a pundit, who everyone respects for his opinions. And I know that I think he's going to do another one this week just to sort of look back on it all, and then hopefully it will return next season for some of the bigger events. Let's hope so. And he did well. The numbers were good. The numbers were very good. He kept it simple. He just, a bit like myself, just recording it on a phone or an iPad and uploading it. And, yeah, every credit, he kept it going. And finally, I just wanted to mention Sheffield itself, actually. I mentioned the snooker community, but the people of Sheffield, not everyone in the city is interested in the snooker, but clearly the local businesses are. And, you know, right from when you get off the train, there's signage, there's a real sense in the city centre that they're proud of the snooker. And of course, you know, we know that the future is uncertain, but it is a place that, as you know, where the tournament has made its home and cemented its home. And it's not necessarily the most economically prosperous place. You know, there are deprived areas, absolutely, which is why, you know, the idea that the council's going to spend tens of millions on a new venue just seems preposterous, actually. There was an interesting story in the Daily Telegraph, though, this week, that just in the last couple of days, that, you know, and this was actually floated on this podcast last week by a listener, but the Saudis possibly could be interested in funding a venue in Sheffield now. I mean, there's no firm information on that, but maybe that's the way forward. But in terms of, you know, the annual pilgrimage to the Crucible is something that a lot of fans look forward to. And Sheffield, the wider sort of environs of Sheffield is part of that as well. And again, they did us all proud. So that's the positive stuff. They're the hits. What about the misses? Well, these are my observations. Okay, I think there was a big problem this year, a big problem with the scheduling of matches. We were very light on drama in the evenings. The evening for local TV and European TV is when most people are going to watch, or are available to watch because they've been out of work all day or at school all day or whatever. So the most likely time people can watch is at night, and also the best atmosphere is usually in the evening. Often people have been at work at day, they come, they might have a drink or two, whatever. But the scheduling this year in the first round was ridiculous, I thought. Here's the thing, okay. Luca Brasel is the number one seed, so tradition always dictates he's going to play Saturday morning, Saturday night. He was the only member of the top eight whose first round match finished in the evening. I'll repeat that because I find it extraordinary. He was the only member of the top eight ranked players in the world whose opening match finished in the evening. All the others finished morning or more likely afternoon. So the sort of supposedly less attractive matches were put on in the evenings. Now, we did get a couple of close matches within that. Robert Milkins beat Pan Junzhu 10-9. But overwhelmingly, the kind of what you think of as the prime session was given, in theory, the worst matches. That is absurd, and that has got to change. And World Snooker Tour have got to step up next year and ensure it doesn't happen again. They have to put on, okay, I understand the BBC, they have a big afternoon programme, which they quite rightly want to have, you know, good stuff on. But it shouldn't be that every day. You've got to spread it round. This is one of the reasons I think people had a bit of a downer on the tournament this year. The scheduling, simple as that. And it's got to be looked at for next year. Because I didn't think it helped. Obviously, you never know how matches are going to turn out. You can have a match, an unattractive match on paper that turns into a belter. You can have an attractive match that turns into a dud. We know that. But I made the point last week. Why do the second round matches need to be scheduled so far in advance in terms of who's playing when the tickets are sold anyway? You know, be a bit more flexible with it. But I thought that was, and also there seemed to be a lot of second round matches this year played over 3 days that dragged on and on. That could be tightened up. I think it needs to be looked at. I'm not suggesting for a minute change the actual format, keep the matches the same length, but maybe just look at who's playing when and what's best for the tournament. And that's best for the tournament that's going around the world and includes the spectators at the Crucible. Some of those sessions at night were a bit flat, to be perfectly honest. And that created the general vibe that the tournament wasn't quite, you know, as good as normal. So that's the main one, actually. There's some small other ones. And this is a small one, to be fair. But the trophy is iconic, okay? There's no other word for it. It's been presented every year since 1927. It's the original Joe Davis Trophy. All the years I grew up watching snooker, and for many years afterwards, it was there on the day of the final, in the middle. You could see it behind the players, behind the brown spot, on the sort of set, on a little wasn't really a plinth, but it was on a set, on the set. This year it wasn't, and I assume that's because it was an LED set, it was a new set, and there kind of wasn't quite room for it. Got nothing against the new set, it was modern, it was dynamic, it was good. But the trophy on during the final needs to be seen somewhere in the arena. It needs to be there to remind everybody what's at stake, to remind the players, actually. I'm not saying bring back the Globes. Well, actually, I'll rephrase that. I'm saying bring back the Globes. they were another part of it. But no, in all seriousness, the trophy needs to be visible during the final. The lifts in the Mercure Hotel. Now, this is first world problems. But we stay at the Mercure, which is just up the road from the Crucible. I think every year I've stayed there, one of the lifts has been out of order. Apparently this year, one day, they were both out of order. Which involves a lot of waiting. There's only so many people can get in them, as you can imagine. And I was on floor four. Now, this is not the most burning issue in the world, but how hard is it to fix a lift? Seriously, you know. I mean, to be fair, the lift repairing game, it does have its ups and downs. We'll leave that there. The media final. Our dear friend David Burney. This was a literal miss. He missed his chance to win. He was in the final, from David Burney from Canada, and he lost on the black. It was only one frame, mercifully. Now all I'll say is, and I was with David the night before, and he prepared more in the vein of Jimmy White back in the day than Stephen Hendry. He lost to Sam from World Snooker. Sam did have one advantage over the rest of the field. He's actually good at snooker, and he retained his title. I don't know what the future of that event holds, really. There was this talk of letting in the sort of pundits, you know, the actual proper players. But anyway, David missed out on his chance to emulate his dear friend Cliff Thorburn. I'll leave it at that. I don't want to be too negative about the tournament because I enjoyed it all as I always do. But I do think the scheduling of matches is one thing that needs to be taken a bit more seriously. In terms of giving a bit more prominence to the evenings. And hopefully that will happen. Now, if you follow American politics, you'll know that for many years, there was a woman, when they went to the White House and the president was there, or even the sort of press spokesman, they would always stop. The first question would always be, they defer to a woman called Helen in the front row. She's an old woman, or she was by the time, you know, someone like Obama came along. And she would always get the first question for some reason. And our Helen is Alpha Bonzi. Alpha Bonzi, a long-time correspondent, he writes in, read a lot of emails, but Alpha's going to get the first question. And as usual, there's more than one. So he starts here, it wasn't a vintage championship, but my God, it was dramatic. My three, not necessarily quick ones, are, and by the way, there's four here, but anyway, he says, what's it going to be like waking up as Karen Wilson will, as world champion, with the trophy now on his mantelpiece? Well, they all say, Alpha, the guys who win the tournament, that it takes a while to sink in. It takes a while to sink in. You could see it sort of visibly dawning on Wilson. He potted the key ball, celebrated. Then he potted another ball, and it looked like he actually couldn't continue. It was dawning on him with every passing moment, every passing second, that he was world champion. But there's a sort of greater realisation that maybe yet to set in. Number two, how big a credit to the game is Jack Jones, and how badly did Trump and Bingham let themselves down, not only with their performances, but moaning about the silent assassin's play? On the latter point, I don't mind, actually, people being bad losers. I think, I don't really know why you wouldn't be at the World Championship, to be honest. But, yeah, their performances were no good. I mean, they've admitted that. Bingham was very disappointed with how he played. Trump in the last session couldn't make a 30 break. You know, he was very, very poor in that last session of that match. Jack Jones is a credit to the game. He went there unheralded, and he came within a few frames of winning the title, and that's brilliant. And it reflects a general shift, I think, in what we've seen in the game, which is the middle ranked players now are really good. They're really good. They win tournaments. They get to finals. There's a chance for any of the guys there really to suddenly break through and become a top 16 player, which is what Jack Jones is now. He'll be the champion of champions because the runner-up in the World Championship gets into that. And, you know, 14 in the world, what an opportunity next season. He'll be in the Shanghai Masters. All that stuff is ahead of him. So, yeah, absolute credit to the game. Number three, did Ronnie O'Sullivan really show great sportsmanship with the black ball rolling off, or did he let himself down with his barracking the referee and the stewards over Doorgate? excuse me. The black thing, I mean, Neil Robertson said it was one of the greatest acts of sportsmanship he'd ever seen. My feeling on it all on that match was that he was very nervous, O'Sullivan. And you could see that, I think, the business with the Desyaslava Boshalova and the, you call it Doorgate, it was the session against Bingham where, the last session where people were coming in. To be fair, he you know, they were in his eye line. He was playing a shot. It was the interval on the other side. They were coming back in, not their fault to take their seats. I could understand why Ronnie was annoyed by that, but he let himself get a little bit fractious about it. And, you know, he told the referee to chill, but actually he was the one who was getting angsty. She wasn't. I thought it was a bit dismissive the way he spoke to her. But more interesting, really, because people do get like that when they're under pressure. More interesting was the fact that he was under pressure. And it shows how much it means to him to actually win. So I couldn't get sort of... I didn't get too sucked into the taking sides on that. It's, to me, it's not about that. It's more what the behaviour actually means. And what it means is, you know, he was feeling it. And it just shows you, again, you know, at that point, he was actually quite a big favourite to win the tournament, but couldn't get the job done in that match. Number four from Alpha. Have you ever held that iconic near 100-year-old trophy yourself? If so, did you feel the history that comes with it? I did do, yeah. A few years ago now, they used to have the launch at the Royal Automobile Club in Pall Mall in Piccadilly in London. And the trophy was there, and I just picked it up. Someone took a picture. I'll be honest with you, I didn't feel the history of it. But that's because I think we weren't at the Crucible. We were standing in a well-to-do place, and it kind of was out of context in a way. But that's I'm not throwing any shade at the trophy, obviously. It was, you know, to be honest, I didn't really want to pick it up. I don't think I've got any business holding that. I know a lot of players have sort of superstitions about, you know, if they don't win it, they're not going to go near it. There's more questions here for Alfie. He says, two quick points. You should recite John Byrne's poem about what the Crucible means to him, to Barry Hearn and Steve Dawson. Maybe they'll stop and think. Yes, it wasn't a poem as such, was it? It was a personal reflections from John recently. Secondly, have there been two better servants to the game, the Rolf Kalb and Paul Collier? Hopefully both enjoy their well-earned retirements. Well, yeah, I mean, Rolf, obviously, I mean, I've spoke about this before, but Rolf retired from German Eurosport last night. some nice tributes from the players that we showed on air, that they filmed. And, yeah, I mean, he has been a brilliant servant. And Paul as well. Paul was going to carry on, though. He's going to be in the tournament office, so we'll see plenty of him, just not refereeing. And Alpha signs off, Finally, I hope you don't underestimate your own contribution to the game. Well, Snooker may not get it, but me and the other listeners to this podcast and viewers of ITV and Eurosport appreciate it. Enjoy your summer break. Very kind of you to say that, Alpha. Thank you. We continue. Callum Law. A lot of people, obviously, are reacting to the events of the 17 days. Callum says, I hope you enjoyed the World Championship. I certainly did. Apologies in advance for the length of the email, but I always like to wait until the end of the tournament before giving my thoughts. For me, the World Championship is the best event every year, and nothing else gets close. This year maybe won't be remembered as a vintage renewal, but once again, it was an absorbing story to follow. Like every year, I found myself putting off doing things and ignoring people to ensure I could watch as much of it as possible. The best player over the 17 days always wins it, and that was certainly the case with Kyron Wilson. The way he reached the final and the level of performance he produced was excellent. In the final itself, he probably fell below the standards of earlier in the tournament, especially after such a good start. But as the tension built up and Jack Jones tried to claw his way back, I still found it a very enjoyable final to watch. I don't wish to be critical of Jack Jones, but I can't help feeling he may look back with a lot of regret. I felt he was below his best in all areas in the final. Wilson handed him more good opportunities in among the balls than he did John Higgins and Dave Gilbert, but I don't think Jones made the most of them. As a John Higgins fan, it feels like a slight missed opportunity. If he could have got past Wilson, it would have been a very good opportunity to win another world title. But what did please me about John's championship was how positive he was about his game, even in defeat. His magical victory over Mark Allen is a match that will go down as one of my all-time favourites to have watched. If ever there was a frame and a break that summed up John, it was the clearance of the last frame against Alan, coming from behind when all looked lost, showing equal amounts of skill and bottle, and one of his trademark doubles thrown in for good measure. I'm now just over with John, where I just enjoy watching him play, regardless of how good, bad or indifferent he is. He's always been my favourite snooker player. He's one of Scotland's finest sportsmen, and I know he can't go on forever, so I'm determined to enjoy whatever he has left. This email is also almost over, I promise. But I also hope we'll see Mark Selby back at the Crucible playing well again in the future. For someone who's given so much to the game, I'd be very sad if Mark retired at this juncture. Away from the on-table action, all this talk about the Crucible and staying or leaving is a bit tiresome, but I'll have my say anyway. Personally, I love the Crucible, but if it goes elsewhere, it will still be the World Championship and I'll still be transfixed by it. I've seen some people say they wouldn't watch it if it left the Crucible. What rubbish. If you're a snooker fan, you'll watch it. What does make me chuckle, however, is all the talk about being able to sell out the Crucible four or five times over, yet during every session of the semis and final, there are empty seats. I know the reason for that will be people still in the corporate hospitality, but with all the talk about moving to a bigger arena, it's quite ironic seeing empty seats inside the Crucible. One last thing, and I say this every year, I'll miss Dennis Taylor when he's gone. What a commentator and what a character. Thanks for all the great podcasts and everything you do for snooker. Thank you, Callum. It's funny, the thing about the empty seats, that was mentioned a few times last night, actually, at the reception, from what I could hear. It was very loud in that room. And I sound like 100 years old now. There were times years ago where I would be there till the lights went up, but I couldn't even contemplate that now. A couple of hours will do me, leave it to the youngsters. But anyway, people were saying, because there were empty seats, and, you know, you're never quite sure the exact reason for that. Obviously, some people buy them a year in advance. You don't know what circumstances change in that time. Some are returned, and it's maybe people don't realise actually that, you know, you can actually get tickets for the final through returns at the box office. So the seats just lie empty. It's not a good look, though. But people were saying, well, you know, if we go to a bigger venue, and we can't fill every seat at the Crucible, why would we fill one at a 4,000 seat venue? But anyway, you've made the same point there, and thank you. Colin Johnston has written, well done to Karen on his victory, the most consistent player of the 17 days, so in that respect, it's well deserved. I'm being harsh, I know, but wondering if he's a slightly lucky world champion, though. The final wasn't a classic, and apart from the first seven frames out of the 32 played, there's an argument that Jack Jones was the better player. However, as Stephen Hendy always says, it's the missing of easy balls that costs you, and Jones missed too many easy balls. How many frames did he give to his opponent? Totally out with Wilson's control, of course, and you can only beat who's in front of you. However, the total rankings of the players he beat to win was 158, an average of 32 per round. He's at the highest total opponent's ranking of recent winners. I don't know about that. I don't think he was lucky, no. I think he played really well from the off. You can only beat the players who you meet along the way, and he did that, and... that's what I would say about that. Colin continues, normally you see the usual horizontal bar chart throughout the championship showing the century break running total compared to previous years. We all know the numbers are down, but didn't see the chart once. What was the final number compared to previous numbers, as we didn't hear it mentioned at all? Thanks for all the great service over the season as usual, and for providing the platform for real snook enthusiasts to join you in conversation. Roll on next season. Yeah, the number, there was 63 centuries, so that was the lowest since 2014. But it's not that it was going up year after year and then it's come down. I mean, 2009, there were a load and then it dipped and then it went up and it sort of gone up and down. But last year we had a lot more than that. I think we had 89 or something. We've had 109, that's the record. So 63, you know, it's still far more than you used to get, but... The total was down, and, you know, people talked about the pockets being tight, and I think there were other issues with the conditions. But look, it's not a human right to have a vintage world challenger every year, and it makes you appreciate more when it is brilliant. You know, it was still really good, but if you were ranking it against some of the others, it's not going to be, I don't think, you know, one of the sort of best remembered ones. Just one of those things, kind of nobody's fault, really. Brian McMahon. Brian from Dublin here. Following decades of procrastination, I finally brought my dad to the Crucible this year. Surreal and incredibly enjoyable. Bingham v. Lazowski, our first match anywhere ever. Like I mentioned, after lengthy dilly-dallying as the first match I can remember is Davis 81. Broadly speaking, and for our sins, we were Higgins fans. More missed than hit. What's seldom is wonderful. Anyway, I just watched the final. Dramatic, error-ridden, and so very enjoyable. Delighted for Carr and Wilson. Now I have a million questions, including who was that mustachioed, bespectacled gentleman who seemed to be at every match on Table 2 bulkend in the 80s to 2010s, and did anyone spot the loose piece of cloth along the bulk cushion in the final? But we'll instead stick to more recent events, the future of any for the World Championship. Well, don't gloss over the mustachioed, bespectacled gentleman. That was Ken Rennick. That was his name, Ken Rennick. Very imposing figure. Always wore a suit, which you don't see so often now. I was saying to Neil, actually, Folds, before we commentated, you know, looking round. Back in the day, half the blokes in the audience would wear suits. Times have changed, and things do change. Very few suits in the audience last night. But anyway, Ken Rennick was his name. Anyway, Brian continues. I like most people, recognise the history to the Crucible, even more so since we made the pilgrimage. However, is there another sport with a global audience and international competitors where its World Championship is held in the same venue every year? Don't say darts, as firstly, it's less global, and secondly, it speaks to the British centricity, which rightly or wrongly shapes this discussion. I don't know off the top of my head, but I was talking to someone about, you know, rotating it around the world, and the point they made was, in theory, it sounds like a good idea, but actually, you're at the mercy of, you know, getting the right venue each year. And if you get a bad one, then you get a bad tournament. At least with the Crucible, you know what you're going to get every year. You know what the limitations are, what the possibilities are. But anyway, thanks for that point. We'll move on to Martin Devlin. Just a couple of reflections on what's been maybe the poorest World Championship I've ever seen. But a poor World Championship at the Crucible is still better than any tournament throughout the season. Regarding Saudi Arabia possibly hosting the World Championship, I just don't buy their supposed interest, and I suspect it's being used as a bargaining chip by Barry Hearn. In other sports, they seem to enjoy being disruptors, but don't touch the sacred cows. In golf, they have created their own events and tour. They haven't shown any interest in the majors or the Players' Championship. The most reassuring example might actually come from WWE. Now, this is wrestling, of course. Their relationship has been in place for a decade now, and again, they created their own shows and have not hosted their biggest events, such as WrestleMania or SummerSlam. Saudi, to me, just seem to be interested in good publicity, and moving showpiece events across any sport would result in the opposite. I sincerely hope I'm right and it stays at the Crucible forever. I thought Ronnie's behaviour in his quarter-final with Bingham was dreadful, and I wish more pundits, or at least one, would call him out on it. I could elaborate, but Nick Metcalf wrote a good piece last week on it, which summed up my thoughts on the issue, which I would encourage the listeners to read if they haven't already. Nick wrote that in the Metro, very well put together, I thought. I mean, the viewpoints have differed on this. Alan McManus on his podcast put the different side to it. He didn't think the referee handled it well. But as I say, I'm actually more interested in what the way he behaved meant for, you know, how he felt. To me, that was more interesting than, you know, deciding on, you know, a sort of running commentary on whether he's right or wrong. The fact that he was bickering and was fractious said a lot about his mental state in the match. And maybe, and this was kind of, few people came up with this as a suggestion, maybe he was under more pressure after Judd Trump lost, because suddenly he's looking at the draw thinking, what a chance to win an eighth. Don't know, but that's a possibility. Martin continues, lastly, at the start of the second session of the final, I thought Rob Walker overstepped the mark. The last line of Jack's introduction was, come on Sheffield, let's raise the roof for Jack Jones. And the last line of Kyron's was, here comes Kyron Wilson. I know the crowd is always likely to be on the underdog side, but it's not the MC's place to encourage it. For me, this is unacceptable in any match, much less the biggest match. I know Rob's a good guy, and I'm certain there was no malice involved, but I really believe regarding player introductions, he needs to tone it down. List the players' achievements, where they're from, and introduce them to the crowd. That's what all other MCs in snooker and other sports do. Why does he feel the need to deviate? Who the crowd supports in any match and in any sport can have a major influence on that match. I believe Rob's intros can influence who the crowd supports by at times being too personal. Thanks for all the great listening throughout the season. I look forward to the same next season. It's an interesting point, which, to be honest, I hadn't really considered, but I don't know whether the intros, the actual words in the intro, do affect who people support or not. I think more naturally, someone who's behind would get support. But anyway, you've made the point, and you've made it very clearly, so thank you. James Howard, I hope you're well and have enjoyed this year's tournament. Just wanted to get your thoughts on something I've noticed the last few days during the final. I'm constantly hearing about how hard it is to get tickets for the tournament as a whole, let alone the final. So I'm a little confused as to why I'm seeing so many empty seats in the arena. Obviously, whilst it's clearly close to capacity, I'm seeing in quite a few rows there are groups of twos and three seats with nobody in them. Do you know or think it's just people not turning up? Or was it not a sellout? And if so, the former, could they not give the seats up to people? For what it's worth, I didn't think this year's tournament has been one of the best, although the Wednesday evening with the Higgins clearance was as good as snooker gets, and I'm a fan of Karen, so I'll be pleased if he can win the final. Spoiler, he did. Anyway, thanks again for your work on another great season. Looking forward to next season already. Have a good summer. Thank you. I mean, to be an absolute pedant here, because it was Monday night when Higgins cleared up, but never mind. I mean, some of the people who should have been in the arena had Century Club tickets and may have been watching it there. That was an issue last year in terms of front rows. It's not a good look, and whatever the reason is, you know, it would be nice to think that those seats would be filled. If it is a question of returns, then maybe more needs to be done to actually tell people that the tickets have been returned to the box office and can still be bought for the final. Andrew Newman writes, just wanted to say a big thanks for all the commentary and podcast during the World Championship. Despite big names getting knocked out, or maybe because of the big name getting knocked out, I thought the tournament was fantastic and had a worthy finish. Jack Jones was brilliant, cool under pressure, calm, resilient, good-humoured and dignified in defeat. Example to us all. And I'm very happy for the Karen Wilson clan. Great to see how Karen talked about teamwork and the support that goes into an individual sports star, his parents, his wife, his brother. After all, no one achieves anything on their own. And finally, I was made up for Barry Stark, having been a fascinated subscriber to his YouTube channel for a few years now. I'm really pleased he got his moment with Karen and the trophy in front of the cameras. Thank you, Andrew. Yeah, I mean, Barry, you know, he's a bit of a legend, actually, isn't he? And he's got that YouTube channel. He's an unlikely star of YouTube, but it's very instructive. One of the nice moments, actually, was Karen's younger son, Bailey, who went over to Jack Jones and sort of gave him a hug afterwards, which was really lovely to see. I mean, that's, you know, that you can't script that or plan that. That was just very spontaneous. And I think that says a lot about kind of the snooker fraternity, really. You know, everyone's kind of in it together. Anyway, thank you for that. Jamie Brannan has written in here with his, I'll just read the email. He says, I hope that this finds you in time for your last episode of the season. Below is my 2023-24 season awards. Okay, so this is Jay Brannan with his award for the season. Best player, Ronnie O'Sullivan. Best match, John Higgins, Mark Allen, the World Championship last 16. Best achievement, Judd Trump's ranking event treble. Best single match performance, Ronnie O'Sullivan against Ding Junhui in the World Grand Prix semi-final. Best overall tournament performance, Karen Wilson in the World Championship. Best analyst, Sean Murphy. Most improved player, Zhang Ander. Magic moment, Sean Murphy's 147 at the shootout. And here, and this is the big one here, the top five snooker scene podcast episodes. I'll go from five to one, okay? Number five, iconic Crucible moments. Number four, the £20 million question. Number three, the Christmas special. Number two, Crucible predictions. And number one, and this is something of a surprise maybe to people, but the 10 greatest British Open finals. All these episodes are there to listen to, if you really want to. Stephen and Michelle in Glasgow, we were watching Eurosport coverage of the concluding session of the final with yourself and Neil Folds, commentating with aplomb as always. Thank you. Neil described Karen Wilson as not being a touch player in the vein of Ding, Allen or O'Sullivan, but instead relying more on his impressive ramrod straight cue power. Whilst it was Neil's view rather than yours, would you agree with the assertion in general? And if so, which other world champions would you say aren't necessarily known as touch players? We'd like to thank you for another brilliant season of the podcast and for kindly featuring a few of our questions over the months. You mentioned some time ago you'd never been to Australia. Will it be this summer, perhaps? No, it won't. But maybe next year. Whatever you have planned, enjoy a well-earned break when it comes. We look forward to your return for the next series. Yeah, I mean, a touch player. I mean, I don't know. My first thought was maybe someone like Graham Dott. I mean, everyone sort of plays the game the same but different in a way. I mean, you're doing the same thing, but you're doing it in a different way. Karen's been, I mean, he said himself, and I understand it, he said, actually, I was a natural talent, which I think is true, But he's been quite heavily drilled as well in terms of technique, and that's all part of it, all the work he's done. But, you know, he got there, and that's the point. I suppose you could argue maybe Peter Ebdon wasn't necessarily a touch player, but, again, he was world champion. Colin Riches writes, I love the podcast, always enjoyable listen. Thank you, Colin. One thing that occurred to me, wouldn't it be nice if tournament winners thanked the referees in their winning speeches? They do a fabulous job, which needs long periods of concentration and often quite difficult situations to deal with. It's not just about picking balls out of the pockets. Keep up the great work. Thank you. Well, the thing about the... I agree with referees do a great job, but one thing about the speeches is, if you look at, for example, Grand Slam tennis, it's quite a long time after the match finishes, because they have a proper ceremony. You know, somewhere like the Australian Open, you know, they have a sort of platform and dignitaries get into position. It's actually quite a while after the final's finished. It might be 20 minutes or so before the speeches starts, which means obviously the winner has time to think about what they're going to say. In snooker, it's literally about a minute after the last ball's gone in, Hazel Irvin appears with the microphone and starts interviewing firstly the runner-up. You don't have time to think what you're going to say. So it just comes out. And I actually love that because it's spontaneous and you just get unfiltered what people think. And it's not actually carefully considered, and quite often they forget to thank people, but that's all part of it. So it's not surprising that, you know, they don't sort of think and mention the referee, because there's just so much going on in their head, particularly obviously if you win the World Championship. But I thought it was a very natural response, certainly from Karen last night. Kevin Higgins, enjoying the final here in Australia on Matchroom Live. Is it me or are the players leaving the arena more regularly after a frame is finished? Thanks for the great podcast to keep you up to date here. Thank you, Kevin. I mean, I've not sort of logged it, but there do seem to be a lot of toilet breaks. We're now getting them actually during frames. But I would say this, okay, and this is not a joke. This is actually a serious answer. There's more water now at the table because they have a water sponsor, and let's not be coy. They're Nongfu Spring. They're a Chinese company, and they have to be displayed there. And so there's a lot of water there. And if you're sat, like, it's such nerves involved, a lot of nervous energy involved in the World Championship snooker. And if you're sat at the seat and the other person's playing, you just sort of sip water through nerves more than anything else. That nervous energy that you can't get rid of. And, of course, nature then takes its course and you end up needing the toilet a lot. So, listen, I don't think every toilet break is actually a player who needs the toilet. Sometimes they just want to get out of the arena, gee themselves up. Maybe they've made a great clearance and they want to sort of keep their opponent sat there. That goes on. But a lot of the time, they just need the toilet. I'll say this, and we get this about sort of, oh, it's taking forever to put the balls back and all this, or we can't use technology because, you know, the time it takes. We're there for 17 days. There's no rush, actually. There's no rush. I don't actually mind if there's a couple of minutes between frames. It gives everyone a chance to collect their thoughts and, you know, we're not in a rush to get the thing played. If we were, it wouldn't last 17 days. Now, Chris writes from Nuki, I absolutely love the show and the witty way it's delivered. I assume he's talking about this podcast, but anyway, thank you, Chris. After watching snooker for over 40 years, I have this morning managed to get tickets for next year's World Championship at the Crucible. I've never been before and cannot wait. My fascination with snooker started as a young lad in the 80s. Coming from Cornwall, we didn't get a lot of snooker down here, but my dad managed to get tickets to see Alex Higgins against Jimmy White at the Cornwall Coliseum. Who knew that Cornwall had a Coliseum? But anyway, I went as a Higgins fan, but Jimmy won 5-0 and my love affair with Jimmy began. Just a shame it had 6 divorces. We also saw Steve Davis against John Parrott on another occasion at the same venue, but needless to say, this was a more timid affair than the Hurricane against the Whirlwind. Anyway, enough of my ramblings. Keep up the good work. Hope to bump into you at the Crucible next year. Next year, I mean, you know, inevitably the Crucible curse has already been mentioned for Kyron. I mean, give him a minute. Give him a minute to get his head around it. Jennifer Best has been to the Crucible this year. This is what she's got to say. Hello, Jennifer. This time last week, I was enjoying a long weekend in Sheffield, where I was lucky enough to see the middle and final sessions of Maguire v Murphy. I know there's been comments read the scheduling of the finish of the Maguire-Murphy match, but personally, I was delighted to get to see a fellow Glaswegian win at the Crucible. I think when it comes to scheduling, it's worth highlighting that the ticket prices on any given day are the same regardless of the session, at least until the one-table setup. Prior to the semi-finals this year, there were 7 finishes scheduled for the morning, 9 for the afternoon, and 12 in the evening. Even taking into account there are two fewer morning sessions. That means people buying morning tickets are less likely to see the end of a match, even though they paid the same price. I don't think that's a big deal, but if there was a move to schedule more matches depending on TV requirements, then I'd imagine that would affect ticket prices, which, let's be honest, is going to mean higher prices for the afternoon and evening rather than cheaper prices in the morning. Fair point, I think that. She continues, on the issue of Crexit, now this is what one listener dubbed leaving the Crucible, Crexit. I came away from Sheffield with mixed feelings. The atmosphere at the Crucible is without doubt something special, but there's definitely a trade-off with the realities of a major sporting event. For example, I don't think the views in the Crucible are that great, at least not where I've been sat. Any time I've been there, either myself or a friend have spent a lot of the match bobbing around trying to get a decent view, and you can see others doing the same. Neither of us are particularly small. It's not a big problem at any other event in a modern arena. Also, we love sitting on the deck chairs at the big screen in Tudor Square with a pint from the head of steam just to add a bit of balance on the pub front. But that area is often shut off. We came to the conclusion that the security staff were needed to get people into the venue, which is fair enough, but a bigger venue catchment area might allow for more investment in things like that. Even if the World Championships move from the Crucible, I hope that another tournament replaces it, as it really is a sporting mecca, and the Crucible, Sheffield, and the fans deserve that, I think. Well, you know my views on that, Jennifer. The Kit Kat break for World Champions would be the tournament that I would put there, and that campaign, we're going to rest it in the summer, but I'm going to step it up later in the year. Jennifer continues, one final point is on the old chestnut of merchandise. Myself and a friend, both female, were a bit taken aback to see this T-shirt for sale, photo hopefully attached, inside the Crucible. Your podcast seems like a family-friendly affair, so I'll leave it to you to decide how to describe it. Well, I've got to tell people what it is. It's a T-shirt, and it says, well, I'll just call the picture up just to make sure I've got it right. You should bear with me. You can see other people would have done this already, but, it's a sort of T-shirt, and it says, snooker players do it with one foot on the floor, and it depicts, well, two people on top of each other, effectively, and on a sort of, well, it's a bed. There's no getting round it. So it's a little rum, really. But anyway, it's not very subtle. And Jennifer says, it was mentioned by another correspondent a while back, but I thought they were joking. I know some people will say this is just a bit of fun, probably followed by love or sweetheart. But in my opinion, it's not. It's crude, sexist, and not appropriate for an event that kids are attending. I've emailed WST, but doubt my email will get read. I mentioned in a previous email to the podcast that I don't feel particularly represented as a female fan, and this is a prime example of what I mean. Incidentally, I did see a number of kids in the audience, including some girls, which is great, but what kind of message does that T-shirt send to young girls, and young boys for that matter? I can't really imagine on sale the official merchandise stand anywhere else, can you? Anyway, that's more than enough for me. Enjoy the final, and thanks for all your hard work. The T-shirt is crass, I think, Jennifer, and a little bit sort of, I don't know, it's a little bit sort of cheap, really. If we're trying to sell a prestige sporting event, you know, it's easy to sort of be accused of not having a sense of humour, but really, in 2024, is that what we're selling at our biggest tournament? So I tend to agree with you, really. You know, it's just a bit, I'll be very blunt about this, it's just a bit shit. And I can't really put it any other way than that. Now, talking of Crexit, we've had an email here from Akif from Istanbul. You see, we've got friends all around the world, just not in this country. But anyway, Akif, thank you for writing. He says, I hope you're doing well. I'm writing just after the first session of the final. Another dreamlike 17 days are almost over. Of course, apart from who will win, the most hot topic is the so-called Crexit. In one of your latest episodes, you said you expected it to move out of the Crucible but stay within the UK, if I caught you correctly. On the other hand, in an episode from a few years earlier, I also recall you claiming it'd be very difficult to move out of the Crucible. You said something along the lines of, do you know how much WST pays the Crucible to hire the venue for 17 days? Can you guess? Well, let me tell you, zero. I also listened to Barry Hearn a few days ago, claiming that the £500,000 first prize can become £5 million, and the players would naturally prefer that to the legacy of the Crucible. Then I got curious as to how much ticket revenue WST makes. I was out walking at the time. I listened to your take on this, and I made a crude calculation in my head. Living in Turkey, I had no idea about the ticket prices at the time, but still Hearn's projection sounded wild to me. Today, however, alongside the final, I looked at the 2025 prices and made a new analysis. Okay, so this is, Keith has done the work here. It says there are 16 first round, 12 second round, 6 quarter final, 8 semi final, and 4 final sessions, in total 46. There seem to be 2 standard categories, varying from £10 to £15 in prices. There are also premium seating, as well as some luxury packages. I'm assuming these have limited numbers, so as the overall average, I took the higher value standard category price. So assuming 1,000 seats, which is roughly the case, the total ticket revenue comes to first round. Okay, I'll just give the figure here. Okay, it's first round, 880,000. Second round, 720,000. Quarterfinals, 480,000. Semifinals, 1,000,000. Finals, 640,000. So the total is 3,720,000. If you go to a 3,000-seat arena, for example, this would roughly triple to around 11 million. I don't see how Barry will pay almost half of this to the winner, when they will probably have to pay a hefty booking fee to the venue, let alone the updated prize money for the runner-up and all the rest. If they move it outside Sheffield, I assume they will go to a big city that will not need the visibility as much as Sheffield, so I deem it highly unlikely that they will find a no-booking fee venue. This is, of course, still a very limited analysis. There are talks of changing the format, God forbid, and they might also boost the ticket prices, but that comes with the risk of empty seats. In any case, I do not see how the picture Barry paints is realistic. I'm not a business person, but I feel like he's not being entirely transparent about their projections, which I'm sure they must have done. You said that he is telling the truth in terms of the financial realities, players' choices and priorities, the biggest event at the smallest venue, etc., and people usually don't like hearing the truth. While I agree with you, and him to a little extent in principle, I'm also highly sceptical of the numbers Barry is throwing around. There was a sitcom a decade ago here in Turkey. Bear with me. I'll tie this in, I promise. A teenager has a crush on their next-door neighbour. When he's alone at home one day, he asks this woman whether she likes kittens. She's elated and says, of course. Then the boy says, come to my room, I'll show you something. She feels uncomfortable a bit and asks, what is it? Do you have a kitten there? He says, well, just come and see. She says, no, you bring it here. He insists a bit more, but she's adamant not to come. Finally, he goes into his room and brings out a TV. It says, I wanted to show you my nice plasma TV. She then is disappointed and yells, why would I want to see your TV? Do you not have a kitten? But of course he didn't. And I feel like Barry doesn't either. That just seems to be the honeypot that he's sort of dangling in front of our eyes. He might have improvements up his sleeve, but nowhere near the level he's suggesting. What I took from that is that the sitcoms in Turkey are pretty wild. If that's the storyline. But anyway, Akib continues, I love the Crucible, but probably my connection to the place is not as strong as many of the others. I've been following snooker for 5 years. It's not like I associated it with fond memories of my childhood. It's also, unfortunately, highly unlikely I'll ever visit the place. I'd love it to stay at the Crucible, but I probably wouldn't feel a huge difference if it moved, especially as soon as the action on the base starts. In fact, I wouldn't understand if it was moved at all, as the stage was fitted to the measurements of the stage at the Crucible. That being said, frankly, Barry acts candid, but doesn't come across very honest. I appreciate it's very difficult, almost an impossible decision, but I really wish it was handled much better. Here's hoping we'll get through this and see many more world championships, each more exciting for the snooker played and not the stuff off the table than the previous one. Well, thank you for that. Thank you for doing all that work on the calculations. I mean, I do feel that there's been, I said it at the time and I stand by it, there's been a lot of kite flying and, you know, sort of putting it out there to see what happens. The decision has not been made to leave. It's not a done deal. Literally, no deal has been done to go anywhere else. So until it is, hope remains it may stay there. Talking of sitcoms, and this is, again, a segue, Mark Wright, he wrote this on the day of the final. He said, just a quick note, the last surviving member of Dad's Army, Ian Lavender, died in February. He was buried on the 29th of February, a rare date. Now we find ourselves with a very unexpected final between Jones and Wilson. It's a tribute, my friend, clear as the spring day in Sheffield. The Lord works in mysterious ways. Let's hope he works his magic to keep the iconic Crucible as the home of the snooker. The simple, unquestionable truth is, anyone who wins the World Championship that's not at the Crucible has not had the unique test that only this wonderful, claustrophobic, atmospheric venue can give. Just my point of view, stupid boy. And, of course, anyone who's never seen... I mean, there'll be people, obviously, from outside the UK who don't know Dad's Army, but the Jones-Wilson thing was mentioned. Of course, Jack, he was actually called Jack Jones the character was called Jack Jones in the sitcom, and his catchphrase was, don't panic, which it turned out he's not what... is what Jones did or didn't do. He didn't panic after going 7-0 down. That was a very long-winded way of getting through that. But anyway, we'll go to Jonathan Ford. Thanks for all your hard work over the past fortnight. Hope you enjoy a well-deserved rest. Thank you, Jonathan. Just as an addition to your Kit Kat break for former world champions idea to resurrect the tournament at the Crucible, what about calling it the Mike Watterson Trophy in memory of the promoter who brought the world championship to the Crucible in 77? Momentum is gathering. Well, let's hope so. Yes, I had the pleasure of speaking to Mark Watterson, Mike's nephew, last week. And, it shouldn't be forgotten the contribution that the Watterson family made. Actually, Mark and Ryan Watterson, who's Mark's son, if you're following this, he works for the WPSA now with Matt Hewitt on the media side. They were on the Talking Snooker podcast this week, so you can listen to them talking about Mike and their memories. But, yeah, I'll bear that in mind when the tournament comes back, which it will, because the campaign, as I said earlier, we'll be stepping up later. Sat Jinder here says, I just wondered, before the advent of modern technology, what would happen with the nightmare scenario that beset Marcel Eckhart during the Jones-Bingham match when Jones missed getting out of the snooker and thundered the balls around the table? How would the referee remember where the affected balls were placed? It reminded me of a Blackadder 2 scene. There's a lot of sitcoms being mentioned this week, but anyway, that's fine. He said, it reminded me of a Blackadder 2 scene where he successfully blackmailed the Bishop of Bath and Wells, paying him money owed by getting Percy to sleep with him, and he told him to get his hands off the portrait because he had some preliminary sketches. it would be very difficult to get the balls back without the technology. Simple as that. They'd have to. The thing is, though, if there was no footage, the players would just accept that and they'd just do their best. Simple as that, really. That answers that. Now, Phil Spivey. Another fascinating world championship, not the final we expected and not a classic, but gripping nonetheless, and a deserved winner in Kyron Wilson. A niche observation, I believe this was the first final since the first stage play was expanded to 17 frames in 2011 to end with an 11-6 overnight scoreline. Incidentally, do you know why they changed the second session from 8 frames to 9? I always liked the possibility of an 8-8 overnight score, although it's hardly a big issue. My memory of that was that, if you go back to some of the finals prior to that, they were finishing very late. They were starting late, 8 o'clock. They were finishing late. The sort of sweet spot for telly really is, if you can get the final to finish sometime between sort of 10 and half 10, I know that's quite a narrow window, it's half an hour, but that's the ideal sort of finishing time. And it was felt that maybe if you played an extra frame on the first day, you would have less to do on the last evening. You'll never know, obviously, what the length of the final will be. But I think actually it did sort of hit that spot last night. And the viewing figures were brilliant. 3.3 million peak on the BBC. I saw, inevitably social media, people before the final said, oh, no one will watch this. No one will watch this final. Well, 3.3 million on BBC Two these days is a massive figure. That is a massive figure. And the BBC will be delighted with that. Not least because, it wasn't Ronnie against Judd Trump or one of the big hitters playing. It was, players who the general public maybe are not that sort of aware of. Phil continues, you mentioned on the last episode that Jack Jones might be the first bearded semi-finalist since Alain Robidoux, but what about Luca Brasel last year, or Kyron Wilson's goatee in at least one of the previous semi-finals? Well, I don't count that as a full beard, I'm afraid. It's facial hair, it's not a full beard. I can't, there's no official ruling on this, but I can't accept that. I was glad to hear you say talk of a breakaway tour has receded. It seems to me any rival tour could only work if at least a few of the very elite players signed up to it. Without the likes of O'Sullivan, Trump, Higgins, etc., such a plan would surely be dead in the water. It does seem that many have now publicly ruled it out, or at least indicated they'll only play in events that don't clash with the WST events. Hope you enjoyed the summer of the podcast. Continue during the off-season. Can I request the return of snooker player bingo? You can request it. It's not to say it'll come back. Yeah, I mean, the breakaway, there's been nothing new on that. Until there is, then, we just wait for developments. But Kyron Wilson was asked specifically, actually, in the press conference about next season, and he just said the future can wait, which is a little bit enigmatic, but I would be absolutely amazed if he wasn't back there next year trying to defend it and, indeed, of course, beat the Crucible curse. Declan writes, I was watching the semi-final between Jack Jones and Stuart Bingham. A talking point was one of the later frames where we were down to the colours and where Bingham refused a relatively straightforward pot on green or brown, opting instead for an awkward snooker, which he bungled, leaving a pot to Jack Jones. It was a bad mistake and showed the pressure he was under. Jack Jones quickly took the frame and we went to the BBC studio for some quick post-frame analysis from Steve Davis and Stephen Hendry. Davis and Hendry were ruthless over Bingham's error, and that's fine. What Davis said wasn't great, but it was passable. He said if Bingham was in the studio commenting, he may agree with us and say he deserves to lose the game based on that error alone. Not a great comment, but that's all right. It was a strong reaction. We all say things like that. Hendry then said that Bingham's play showed his ranking. That's the kind of play is the behaviour of a mid or low ranked player. We hear so often about the strength and depth of the game today, but in another breath, there are derogatory remarks made about the mid ranks. If a player makes a mistake under pressure, or even a foolish error over a long match and tournament, it doesn't strike me as an analytical observation to say he played that because of his low ranking number. An analyst who speaks like that merely betrays the stigma they attach to a ranking number, which says something about the analyst, nothing about the player. But when that analyst is the game's most prominent critic because of his achievements on the table, it seems to give him licence to command respect for meaningless remarks. And this is the same analyst who has popularised the phrase serial winner in snooker. We hear this ad nauseam from Hendry. Does it not strike anyone how tasteless this phrase is? After all, serial winner can only be an adaptation of the phrase serial killer. Or am I missing something? What is it that makes a great observer of the game of snooker or any sport? Is it nuance regarding the competitor's character during the game? Nuance is absent from the mind of Stephen Hendry. I think he's on record as saying his favourite film is Wolf of Wall Street. When it comes to bonuses for players, he will always talk about a nice watch or car for the deserving player, like the Bentley he once got. This man is in his 50s, and of course is entitled to his preferences for cars and watches. But my goodness, this man is, as an observer of the game, sits at a black and white anvil with a black and white hammer and rings out his comments unchangingly year after year, decade after decade. Surely it suggests a clue as to how his game faded as rapidly as his youth, because with age comes nuance, but Hendry still speaks as he spoke in his 20s. Well, it's quite a trenchant missive there from Declan. I like Stephen on the punditry. I think it's refreshing to have somebody who will actually have a go like that. You may not like some of his phraseology and some of his conclusions, but it's not all platitudes. And I like the idea that, well, it's not the idea, it's the reality that he's saying on camera what he would say off camera. And let's be honest, not everyone in the world of sports punditry is like that. So, but anyway, you know, you made your point very, very trenchantly, and thank you for that. Brian Campbell, may I add to the collection of nondescript encounters with snooker players? Wednesday night, as I was finding my seat for the O'Sullivan-Bingham match, none other than Rebecca Kenner stood up to let me shuffle along to my seat. Wow, Rebecca Kenner, I exclaimed. Loved your interview on the Talking Snooker podcast. I then took my seat. He got me thinking to an absolute non-event where there was zero contact in 2003 or 2004. I'd been to see top rock band Status Quo at the Fairfield Halls in Croydon. Just on that, Brian, they had a tournament there, the Champions Cup, who sort of Champion of Champions forerunner, I suppose. It's just extra information. Anyway, I was flying back to Glasgow the next day from Gatwick, and who should be in the departure lounge but Alan McManus. In those days, before camera phones, I thought about asking for an autograph as opposed to a photo. However, I figured that he'd be knocked out whatever tournament had been taking place at Brighton, so it might not be the right time. Perhaps an opportunity missed as I left him alone with his thoughts. I know these are non-stories, really. However, I always chuckle when I hear similar tales on your excellent podcast. To end on a more positive note, I've been loving my time in Sheffield. I come by myself, however, the snooker community is so friendly. On Wednesday in the Graduate, I met a great bunch of lads over from Galway and also enjoyed a chat with respected journalist Nick Metcalf. On Thursday, the sun was out and there was the loveliest atmosphere in Tudor Square with lots of people enjoying the action on the big screen. And tonight, I was chatting to a guy who'd come to the Crucible all the way from Brazil. You truly are never alone at the World Championship. No, they're quite right, and I kind of made that point. You know, it's a community, and the point is everyone's there for, you know, the same reason, which is they love snooker. Andy in Yorkshire, lots of chins have been wagging, read the Crucible and its suitability and sustainability as a host venue for the World Championship. In my humble opinion, World Snooker Tour could do worse than just having a simple switch up of venues between the Triple Crowns. World Championship at the Ali Pali with its 2,000 plus capacity in a capital location for international visitors, keep the format similar to as it now, with a split partition across two tables for round one and two, but then make it a single table from the quarters onwards. I've done a deep dive on how this could be structured, but I won't bore you with it now. UK champs at the Crucible with all the games as a showpiece event in a one-table setup. Maybe make it a best-of-15 tournament with one full match on each day, with seven plus eight frames in the afternoon and evening session across 15 days. given the UK now has reduced to a 60-man tournament, this could be feasible. I'd say straight away that's not feasible at all. No TV company is going to show the UK Championship for 15 days. Manchester Central for the Masters, as that seemed very popular, is more accessible for all parts of the UK, closer for the Welsh and Irish fans, and better transport links for Scots and Southerners. Atmosphere seemed very upbeat, probably due to a central urban position, and might get the same feeling as the Wembley Conference Centre. Possibly play the English Open at the Barbican. York is very English, I suppose. Feel free to pass on my thoughts to anyone in the snooker world that might consider this suggestion. Well, thank you, Andy. I mean, I've said before, I just don't agree with changing the venues for tournaments. The Masters works at Ali Pali. It's a London event. It should stay there. I think the World Championship works at the Crucible and should stay there. And actually, I like York for the UK, although, you know, there's talk of that going somewhere else. But a lot of people have said, you know, not alone, I'll put the Masters there. No, the Crucible's about the World Championship. It would actually be a bit confusing if the Masters went there, I think. Now, look, I may be wrong. If it happened, it may be great. But I just don't like the idea of it. Craig in Edinburgh. Really enjoying the World Championship this year and the unexpected lineup we have in the semi-finals. I'm watching the Friday afternoon session as I type this, and I wonder why Jack Jones doesn't wear a bow tie. I'm only aware of Stephen Maguire as having permission to have an open collar due to a medical condition. I hope World Snooker Tour are not starting to relax the dress code for the tournament. Well, he has a medical exemption. I'm not sure exactly what it is, but it's usually to do with sort of a neck rash and so on. That's what Maguire has got his for. So that's it, really. Yeah, I mean, would he have become the first world champion not to wear a bow tie? Was Alex wearing one in 82? I can't remember now. I can't remember. Anyway, I'm sure someone will tell me. Stuart Clark. There was something so predictable about Ronnie O'Sullivan losing his match and then coming out to the media suggesting he was only playing due to sponsorship requirements. I'm a huge fan of his snooker, but it's the pathetic predictability of him coming out with that sort of nonsense become so tedious. We all know he's desperate to win an 8th world title, and I've always felt his protestations to the contrary are just a coping mechanism. Stick to the snooker, Ronnie, and at your age for once. Very, very direct. And Tony Curran, similar vein really, just wondering what your take is on O'Sullivan's interaction with the referee in the quarter final. Not his finest hour, I feel. Well, I kind of covered that earlier. I mean, yeah, I thought it was all a bit unsavoury, but as I've said now, probably for the third time, I was more interested in what it kind of meant for how he was feeling, and he was clearly feeling under it, and you know, he just was, and there's nothing wrong with that, you know, kind of everyone is at the Crucible, but it was sort of revealing of his general mood, I suppose. People will form their own views on the rights and wrongs of it, I'm sure. John, who's been, well, he went there every year since 83, couldn't get a ticket this year, they were too expensive, which is a great shame, and that is an issue at the Crucible. I know they've gone up again next year. But anyway, John says, a few snooker thoughts on the morning of semi-final Friday. What an enjoyable World Championship it's been. The tighter pockets and heavier playing table took me back to the heady days of the early 80s. There's been lots of battles on the colours. Also, I've been wondering on nearly every shot whether an attempting pot will be successful. Keep the pockets tighter. Regarding Crexit, much will be lost regarding the marketing appeal of snooker if the Crucible is rashly discarded. The theatre atmosphere and the limited numbers are part of what makes the event such a spectacle. Watching there, it feels almost a different sport to other venues and tournaments. To those who say there are insufficient tickets, try buying from the website a few days before. Except for the last day of the final, I've always nearly been successful. As of right, having just checked, the cheapest tickets are still available for all the five remaining sessions of the semi-finals at the first evening of the final. The World Championship at the Crucible isn't broken, so don't try to fix it. Thank you for that, John. It does rather give the lie to the idea that, oh, you can't, you know, you've got to get your tickets because they're all going to go within minutes. Clearly, that's not true, is it? You know, or certainly tickets become available later. John continues, offer the currently not played World Match Play Championship to the highest bidder anywhere in the world. Okay, that's out of left field, but okay. I hope an additional elite tour takes off with invitational events around the world. If not clashing with existing events, this could only be good to promote the wonderful game to the markets worldwide. Bring back the kick-gap break for world champions. Run a pot black style seniors version for the over 60s alongside the event for players still on tour. The podcast have helped make this championship one of the best for years. Thanks for all the entertainment you're providing us. Well, that's very kind of you. And I'm glad that despite not going, you were able to still enjoy the coverage. Lars Johansson, he says, sorry for another lengthy email. Feel free to crop as you see fit. Well, like I said about the tournament, we're not really in any rush, are we? So we'll just, I'll just read it out, Lars. What an odd tournament we're having. So he's written this as the semi-finals were getting underway. I bet no one would have guessed this semi-final lineup. If they did, I hope they bet on it. Can now reap great financial rewards. We talk about what might happen. Obviously, we know that already, so I'll gloss over that. The talk about the possibility of the World Championship leaving the Crucible after the 2027 contract is up. I won't speculate whether or not it will happen or where it would be going. No point. We'll see what happens. More importantly to me, what this conversation has done is sparked my motivation to try and get over to Sheffield in the next few years so that I can be part of the Crucible history. This, even if I feel like the Crucible experience is too big to handle. But that's what he said when he came to York, of course. But based on my UK Championship experience, I have to try to make it to the Crucible. It was such a special time. Not only was the snooker great, it was awesome meeting you and the spaceman quickly. That's Dominic Dale, of course. And to be interviewed by both World Snooker Tour and Eurosport took it to the next level. Very special memories that I will cherish for the rest of my life, for sure. Plus, as a random bonus, I got upgraded to business class, flying with BA back to Canada. Perfect cherry on top. Only problem, now I know how nice that is and feel like a chump. Flying regular, poor man's class. I can only dream of making it to the Crucible. It's a big trip from Atlin, British Columbia, but I hope I will be able to. I have to make it over before it's too late. It's only one car ride, three flights, and a train ride away. 30 to 35 hours or so no biggie. Time to save money and get my priorities straight. I hope to see you and all the fans at the ultimate snooker venue in a year or two. Thanks as always to your dedication to snooker. Well, thanks to yours as well. And if you can come, it's a long trip, but if you can come, I guarantee you'll enjoy it. And that's, I don't guarantee much, but you will enjoy it. That's just a fact. So if you can come, please do come. Kerry Richards, I was nodding along in wonderment at the reference of the latest episode of Jack Jones being the first bearded player to make the semi-finals at the Crucible since 1997, then check the video of Gary Wilson playing Judd Trump in 2019. To be fair, you did caveat your statement by saying proper beard and not stubble, so we may have to agree to disagree on whether Wilson's effort was a baby beard or nothing of the sort. Yeah, they're not beards for me. I mean, I know we're getting sidetracked here by talking about facial hair, but they're not beards. We'll leave the emails there. Thank you to everyone who's written in. As I left Sheffield today, I did think about what a remarkable event this World Championship is. Not just for the actual snooker played, but for the environment it creates and the memories it makes. Put simply, it means an awful lot to so many people. So that's it from the Snooker Scene podcast for another season. I was there for the first day of the Championship League in the summer. I was there for the end of the World Championship final at the Crucible. And I was very lucky to have worked at every event on the World Snooker Tour in between, something I assure you I don't take for granted. This podcast only exists because of its listeners, so thanks to every single person who's written in with questions, comments, jokes, tirades, and bad puns. Every email is appreciated, and if you just prefer to listen, then thank you for that too. There are more snooker podcasts around than ever, as there should be, but I genuinely feel that the co-presenter on this one is you, the audience. We'll be back later in the year after a break, which I think we all need. I just want to finish by saying well done again to Karen Wilson. You have good days and bad days in life. You have days when you scream with laughter and days when you cry in despair. And you have mundane days in between that simply merge into one. It's all part of the bigger picture. But Karen will never forget the day he became world champion. And for those of us there and all those people around the world who are watching, neither will we. Do keep your emails coming in to snookerscenepodcast@mail.com, snookerscenepodcast@mail.com, and we'll be back in due course. Do listen also to the other podcasts on the Sports Social Network. But for now, for the last time this season, thanks for listening, and as we always say, goodbye-bye.
Sports Social Podcast Network.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.